All right, you're very welcome along to this week's NFL, OTB NFL pod, and thanks very much for your patience. We were away last week, or certainly I was away. I managed to catch up with the Philadelphia Eagles against the Indianapolis Colts in person, and the Philly fans are everything that you would expect and hope them to be. They booed any of the Colts fans who were brave enough to sit in their section of the stand, and they drank their heads off, and they booed and hooted and hollered exactly as advertised. So if you ever get the chance to go and watch the Philadelphia Eagles play at home, then I would highly, highly recommend it as a sports event. Let's move on. I'm delighted to say we've got Sam Monson of PFF with us this week. Sam, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Yeah, speak for yourself, Jared. The rest of us were all sitting here waiting. You're the guy that was away.
Very good. You work Sunday, so you don't get to go to many games.
No, the last game I actually went to was when the Bengals played on Thursday night a couple of weeks ago. We went and sat in the press box for the Bengals-Ravens game, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, generally we're kind of, certainly on Sundays, we're in the building doing the Sky stuff, so we don't actually get to go to many games.
I would definitely recommend hanging out with Philadelphia Eagles fans. They drink from 10 o'clock in the morning and they don't stop. I was informed that most grounds stop the drinking at halftime. Clearly, they do things a little bit differently.
Yeah, well, any team fan base that's happy to boo Santa Claus is, I think, special and probably worth seeing in person.
Two specific things I wanted to talk to you about this week. Obviously, the grading system that PFF have a couple of weeks in allows us to spot some trends that are beginning to emerge. And while preseason, there was a very high expectation that Minnesota had both the attacking capabilities and the defense to make a Super Bowl run, it turns out their offensive line is on pace for being historically bad.
Yeah, I mean, it looks neither of those things may end up being true. The defense is getting exposed more than we thought it would. But yeah, the offensive line looks to be a major problem. That, at least, I think was predictable heading into the season. On paper, they just did not have the personnel to be really good on the offensive line. And, you know, a guy like Pat Elflein, for some reason, everybody was really high on last year as a rookie center. Never graded well at all at PFF. In fact, was grading badly. And I think offensive line is one of the strongest areas we grade because we're not that interested in the sort of mental highlight reel of what goes on. When you watch a game, you tend to kind of remember the big plays either end of the scale, the really good ones, the really bad ones, and sort of throw out the rest in between as, you know, they're average. But it's the ones in the middle really where all of the information is. That's kind of what determines how good or bad a guy is. And Elflein just was never really that good. So the offensive line, the number I tweeted out was that they're on pace, I think, for like 324 total pressures over a season, something like that. And the most we've ever seen over a season, I think, is 250-something. So they're on pace to shatter that by about 70. To their credit.
The average apparently is 160 a season. They've already had 80. In four games, they've had half an average season.
Yeah, pretty much. Last week, I think, two guys combined for 20. An offensive line, you know, on average gives up 10 in a game, and just two members of that line gave up 20. So it's a real problem. They have attempted by far the most passes in the league, so it's a little bit of a skewed stat. If you look at it on a per-pass basis, they're a little bit better off, but they're still down there with Arizona and Houston as essentially the three worst offensive lines in the game. And Arizona certainly have no playoff pretensions. Houston do a little bit, but again, it's the same problem. Those two teams, they have talent, but their offensive lines are so bad, they just can't sustain that long term.
So here's the question. If you guys knew it, and they have access to the stats that are showing this up, why don't teams fix their problems in the offseason?
I mean, it's not that easy. The Vikings over the past few years, I mean, it's not like they don't know their offensive line has issues. They've had a couple of mitigating factors in there. They lost offensive line coach Tony Sperano. He died suddenly of a heart attack in the offseason. I don't know what impact that has on the line, but it can't be good. And, you know, they've attempted to add personnel to that line for a few years. They traded for Brett Jones just before the season began. When it became clear that Pat Elflein wasn't going to start the season. But I think they just haven't been good at identifying offensive line talent. You know, they've drafted a few players. They've never really panned out. And the league generally, I think, has a bit of an offensive line problem. They're not able to develop them the same way they used to, and there aren't that many good ones around to begin with. So if you have a poor offensive line, it's not necessarily an easy thing to fix. Houston is another good example. They revamped basically the entire line, replaced almost every single starter, but didn't replace them with better players. They're just different bad players.
Yeah, Houston did trade away a good quality left tackle last year, or left guard. Certainly somebody who was good.
Dwayne Brown.
Yeah. It seems odd that this is such a fundamental part of the game that teams don't focus more on it. Is part of this to do with the salary restrictions, because you've paid this money for your quarterback and tying up $100 million in Kirk Cousins prevents you from then investing the way that you would have done if, say, you had somebody slightly cheaper?
I mean, that's the salary cap is always an element to any kind of roster building exercise. For the Vikings, I don't think the Kirk Cousins thing specifically prevented them from doing anything. Let's say they had all the money in the world, where were they going to spend it this offseason? There was only really one top quality offensive lineman on the market, and that was Andrew Norwell, the left guard that went to the Jacksonville Jaguars. So, I mean, there's not that many places they could have thrown money at it to fix the problem, even if they'd wanted to. I just think that they've had a fundamental issue for a while now, identifying offensive line talent. And then even if they found a guy that's talented, there's no method of developing this guy anymore. You know, there's no NFL Europe, which used to be a great bed for developing offensive linemen.
Okay. Is this going to fundamentally prevent the Vikings from going as deep in the season? Like, is this something that they can fix in the next 6 to 10 weeks?
I think they may. I mean, they'll get better than they have been so far, purely on the basis that they've been about as bad as you could possibly be going forward. But I think this is the thing that puts a cap on how good they can be. If you think back to the NFC Championship game against the Eagles, obviously that was a disaster for the Vikings. But I think the single biggest thing in that game is that the Eagles' front seven was just getting relentless pressure on Kirk Cousins. They pressured him 48% of his dropbacks in that game. There's generally a sort of sliding scale of how much you're pressured as a quarterback and how bad that has an impact. If you're over 40%, it's bad. If you're over 45%, it's really bad. And if you're at anything like 50, you're basically forget about it. The quarterback cannot function under those circumstances. And Kirk Cousins in the NFC Championship game was at 48. He's going to be at that kind of level pretty much throughout this season. So you're basically asking him to do something that has never been done sustainably at any kind of level to in order for them to go as far as they want to go.
So I think, also taking all of that stuff into consideration, Kirk Cousins has been playing at an elite level. Is it fair that it's a very early sample size that we have to say that he is performing at an elite level, and if he continues to do so, he will be considered elite?
Well, I think he's been inconsistent. So he was bad in that Buffalo game. He was bad for half of the Green Bay game before bringing them back. What he's shown is that he's capable of doing the thing that they brought him in to do, which is if you find yourself 14, 17 points down in a game, he's a guy that can actually bring you all the way back and at least get, or at least and at least contend in a shootout. If they'd had Case Keenum at quarterback, I don't think they're capable of doing that. I don't think they're capable of coming back in the Green Bay game, albeit to tie. I don't think they're capable of living with the Rams in a shootout, again, albeit in a game they ended up losing. But I think he's done what they brought him in to do, which is show that he's a guy that can make those big-time throws and, you know, at least elevate things when the other things on the team aren't functioning.
I wanted to ask you another about the PFF grades of the first-round picks in this year's draft are out for the first 4 weeks, and Baker Mayfield is grading really well at the moment.
Yeah, Baker Mayfield is a guy that PFF loved all the way through the process. So we watch and grade every single player in the NFL, but we also do it of every FBS game, essentially Division I of college. So we've had the last three seasons of Baker Mayfield's starting career there, and he had the number one and the number two single seasons we've ever seen from a quarterback. So higher than Jared Goff of Carson Wentz. He was an FCS quarterback, but we did his games as well. Higher than Jameis Winston, the Marcus Mariota, all these guys. Baker Mayfield was number one and number two. His accuracy was off the charts. He just looked like an absolutely phenomenal quarterback. And I think just his size really dinged him in the idea of a lot in the mind of a lot of people. He's a 6'1" guy, doesn't look like Josh Allen. And honestly, I think Josh Allen being in the same draft almost magnified the misconceptions about Baker Mayfield. In any other draft, you would be looking at Baker Mayfield's arm and saying, okay, he may only be 6'1", but the guy has a cannon for an arm. But put next to Josh Allen, nobody has a cannon for an arm because that guy's just got freaky arm strength and he's 6'5" and all this kind of stuff. So I think people kind of slept on Baker Mayfield a little bit. The Browns didn't. They drafted him number one overall, finally gets in the game, and the offense just looks different when he's there. It's the same thing that happened with Jimmy Garoppolo and the 49ers. I don't think C.J. Beathard is a terrible quarterback, but you put Jimmy G there, it just looks different. And that's the same thing with Baker.
The other thing, it's funny you mentioned the size. Again, like, I hadn't realized that Nick Foles was 6'6", and I hadn't realized that Carson Wentz was 6'5", until you're in the stadium, the stadium announcer announces that he's 6'6", and it's up on the screen. You're like, okay, these guys are actually absolutely massive.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a trend, and especially when somebody like Wentz is such a great athlete and nimble on his feet the way that he was, certainly last season, is maybe getting a little bit of a back, you begin to see that, like, oh, if I can have a good big one, as the saying goes, it's always better than a good little one. Like, 6'1" and an athlete is a fairly reasonable athletic specimen in most sports, with the exception of basketball, really. So is this kind of something else that we start seeing a trend that maybe smaller quarterbacks begin to get reevaluated on the back of a tiddler like 6'1" Baker Mayfield?
I think there's enough guys in the league now where it's not a reason to stop liking a guy. You know, if you have a quarterback and you say, well, this guy's tape's fantastic, but he's only 6 foot. Well, he didn't just turn 6 foot yesterday. Like, he's been 6 foot through the entirety of his college career. If it hasn't been a problem then, it's probably not going to start being a problem at the NFL level. So, you know, I think Russell Wilson, Drew Brees, obviously has been in the league for ages. He's only 6'1". Russell Wilson, I think, is under 6 foot. I think he's 5'11". But there's now three quarterbacks that could potentially be top-level guys who are all shorter than the height you want for this prototypical quarterback. I think, you know, NFL teams at this point have to start saying, let's evaluate this fairly. Okay, maybe we'd like him to be 6'6", but if he isn't, I don't care, because he's shown that he can overcome that.
Yeah, in the week, Drew Brees sets another passing record in the NFL. Surely feet will begin, the penny begins to drop a little bit. The other interesting thing before we leave the Browns was that Denzel Ward is also grading out really well. This was a fairly controversial pick from the Browns at number four. There was a lot of suggestion that actually the best player in this draft wasn't one of the quarterbacks, that they should have gone with Bradley Chubb, number one overall. Ultimately, the Browns, it's proving out at the moment, have had an excellent draft.
Yeah, I mean, Baker Mayfield, number one, I think, was a great pick because we thought he was the best quarterback in this draft. But Denzel Ward over Bradley Chubb may have been the smartest thing they did in this draft. One, PFF was a little bit lower on Bradley Chubb than most people. When we looked at our college grading, the guys that have graded at this really elite level in college when it comes to pass rush have been the guys that have translated immediately to the NFL level. So guys like Joey Bosa, who's just a phenomenal college pass rusher. And the guys that have been just that step below, just in the 80s rather than the 90s of PFF grading, they have struggled to translate, particularly when it comes to pass rushing. And Chubb's highest grades were just in that 80, 88, 89 level. He never quite got to that Joey Bosa level. So we were saying, you know, let's just cool the love for Chubb a little bit. I don't know if he's going to be that phenomenal pass rusher. And then even if he was, what we've discovered in this offseason, digging into all of our data and projecting expected points added and all this kind of complicated analytics stuff, is that coverage is actually more important than pass rush. And it logically makes sense, right? If you have a pass rusher and he doesn't get to the quarterback and the ball is in the air, the cornerback can still fix it. He can still break up that pass. He can still prevent a catch. He's the guy that stops that being a big play. If the cornerback screws up, there's nobody fixing that on the back end. You know, it's done. It's a touchdown. So those guys are where you really see the value. And you can see it anecdotally over the past couple of seasons. You know, Marshawn Lattimore comes in, immediately transforms the Saints defense. Tre'Davious White has a rookie of the year caliber season. Buffalo's defense suddenly massively overachieves. So Denzel Ward looks legitimately like a number one shutdown corner. And that has had a major impact on that defense, far more than a guy like Bradley Chubb and the pressure that he's managed to create so far in Denver would have had.
It's funny because you definitely listen to a lot of the old school former GMs, people who've been around the league, and they're like, oh, it's all about getting pressure on the quarterback. If the quarterback is under pressure, I mean, the stat that we were talking about earlier on with Kirk Cousins, if you can get them over that 45%, you're going to win games generally. But it's the stuff that affects the passing is actually kind of the goalkeeping effect of the cornerbacks. Is there always going to be that tension between one front office who wants the pass rush and one who actually decides that they're going to go early in the draft for the shutdown corners? Or is the trend so specific now and so evidence-based that we're actually going to see pass rush drop over the coming years in the draft?
Well, that's the thing. So pass rush is still really important, and particularly if you're phenomenally good at it, if you're able to get pressure at that kind of Eagles rate, 45% plus, you're going to have a major effect on every single game. The key is in individual decisions. You know, if you have one shot and you can either address pass rush or coverage, what do you go for? And there the data says you have to go coverage. There's like a sort of hierarchy of what you need in the NFL level that all the data points to. It's obviously quarterback first, being able to pass the ball. Next is receivers, because you need somebody to catch the ball at the end of the thing. Then it's coverage. Can you stop the pass? Then it's pass rush. Can you pressure the opposition, kind of impact their pass? And just there's this very clear hierarchy of things that you need to address in a specific order. And all of the data points that way. And what's really fascinating is that at the bottom end of this, well, above special teams, which we don't really count, but at the bottom end of this hierarchy is anything to do with the run game. So running the ball, stopping the run, you almost don't need to care about that in today's NFL, unless you are catastrophically bad at stopping the run to the point where teams can just run at 6 yards a carry every single play. It's almost inconsequential to whether you're winning or losing games.
In the rest of the grading for the 32 rookies picked in the first round, were there anything else that stuck out? Anybody else getting kind of a late round bargain, or anybody else up near the 77 that Denzel Ward was getting?
I think Derwin James, the safety of the Chargers, is proving to be one of the steals of the first round. Again, I'm not entirely sure how he slipped. He was a guy that was a phenomenal college player. And one of the funny things is that my colleague Steve Palazzolo joked during the draft that Florida State used to deploy him all over the defense, and they would line him up legitimately as an edge rusher on the line of scrimmage. And he said that he was a better pass rusher than Bradley Chubb in the lead up to the draft, just to kind of make the point that we're not really in love with Bradley Chubb, but also that Derwin James is incredible. And so far through 4 weeks, he actually has more sacks than Bradley Chubb, and I think more total pressure as well. So even just as a blitzer from safety, Derwin James has been an incredible pass rusher. Plus, he's amazing at everything else.
Yeah, is it just that safety, for whatever reason, the whole league had a little bit of a hissy fit and didn't fully understand the value of safeties?
Yeah, I think the value of safety has probably diminished it a little bit, but we're only, you know, a couple of years removed from Jamal Adams going at the top of the draft to the New York Jets. So I don't think safety generally has been that depressed, but I mean, he's... Teams that dramatically could have used him, say the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, pass on him to draft a giant nose tackle in Vita Vea. And that there's almost no possible way that that can be the right decision based on everything we know about those players.
Okay. One last question. The return to form of the Patriots is kind of something that you could pretty much set your watch by. Is it real this time, or was that just the Miami Dolphins laying a bit of an egg in Gillette Stadium at the weekend?
Yeah, that must have been about as demoralizing a defeat as the Dolphins could possibly have received. You know, they're 3-0. The Patriots are not good at the moment, and yet they still managed to walk in there and beat the crap out of the Dolphins. So for the Dolphins, you must be looking at that and going, well, that's pretty much the season gone. If we can't beat them under these circumstances, forget about it. The Patriots were interesting. A large part of that, I think, is Miami. But they do have Josh Gordon now. They get Julian Edelman back this week. So the potential for a lot of their passing problems to disappear is there. Edelman in particular always has a transformative effect on that offense. He's the guy that is always open for 5 yards. So whenever the Patriots need 5 yards, they can find Julian Edelman, move the chains that way. And then Josh Gordon brings that ability to just take the top off a defense and have a big play every now and again. Even if he doesn't fully integrate his way into the offense, he can be a big threat there. So I think the Patriots could be beginning to turn this around, certainly on offense.
Yeah, because you have to keep an eye on Josh Gordon, which suddenly means that there aren't two people keeping an eye on Rob Gronkowski, and all of a sudden those two little bits transform things a little bit. Anything else that you're particularly looking forward to this weekend or working on at the moment that you think we should be talking about?
I think this is a big game, the replay of the NFC Championship game. The Vikings and the Eagles, both those teams have dropped games. Both those teams kind of find themselves in a bit of a hole. And for the Vikings in particular, I mean, if they lose this week, their season is almost done. So I think it's going to be fascinating. And I think it kind of could be another replay of what we talked about. That front seven of the Eagles going up against that offensive line of the Vikings. they've got the better part of a week to figure out how they stop that being an absolute slaughter.
What do? You just try and get the ball out as fast as you possibly can? Do you, like,
yeah.
How do you trick the fact that you've got such a bad offensive line?
Yeah, I mean, there's only two things you can really do. There is the speed at which you get the ball out of your hands, all kinds of quick passes, just get it rid before anybody has a chance to beat their man and kill the quarterback. And the only other thing you can do is misdirection. So, you know, motion, counterplays, any kind of trickery in the backfield that just makes those guys hold up for a second and try and diagnose the play instead of just coming straight at you, pinning their ears back and going after the quarterback.
Sam, great stuff. Great to talk to you. Thanks a million.
Yep, you too. Take it easy.
It's Sam Monson there from PFF joining us on the show this week to talk to us about what was going on. I'm going to run you through the results now from last week, and we'll talk about the fixtures as well. Okay, so that's this week's fixtures. So as I said there, Colts and Patriots at the top. It's the Titans at the Bills. This is going to be an interesting game because all of a sudden the Titans look a little bit frisky and Marcus Mariota is getting feeling back in his hands. After that, it's the Dolphins obviously coming off that loss last week at the Bengals. 2-3-1 teams, but I think you probably feel a bit happier about life if you were a Bengals fan. It's the Ravens at the Browns, which is also all of a sudden an interesting game. The Browns are 1-2-1, but they could easily be 4-0 at this point. The Ravens have three wins to their name. It is the Packers at the Lions, also a relatively interesting game at the moment, just how things are going. Packers have a superior record to how they've actually been playing. And then the Jags against the Chiefs is one of the games of the weekend, obviously. It's our first opportunity to see Patrick Mahomes up against a team with pass rush and defense. The other games of note this weekend, the Broncos at the Jets. The Falcons are at the Steelers. That's going to be a points fest at Heinz Field. That one is at 6 o'clock our time. So we will actually get to watch that game, I think, on Sky on Sunday. The Giants at the Panthers. The Raiders at the Chargers is the evening, the first of the evening kickoffs. The Vikings at the Eagles, again, one of those 9 o'clock. Will I stay up to watch the end of this or not? Will I be bleary-eyed and work in the morning? And the Cardinals against the 49ers, which, funnily enough, nobody's going to be watching because it's going to be completely shit. And the last couple of fixtures we have for you this weekend, I think, are about to come up, if I can just remember. Nope. Last couple of fixtures, we don't have them for you there. I'll try and remember what they were and tell you. Oh, there, yeah. Redskins and Saints is Monday Night Football. Cowboys and Texans is the nationally televised game of mediocrity. And the Rams against the Seahawks is going to be a paddling in Seattle for the Seahawks. Kian Fahey is with us as ever this week. Kian, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm good. Is Patrick Mahomes the greatest player in the history of the game of American football?
I'm not sure about that, but he might be the greatest player of the 2018 season so far. The fascinating thing about Patrick Mahomes is we've had quarterbacks have these bloated touchdown to interception ratios in the past. Even like Carson Wentz last year, you can go back to Derek Carr 2 years ago. You can go back to Nick Foles' first stint in Philadelphia. You can go back through all these different quarterbacks. Even Dak Prescott, as someone in his rookie season, had that little bit of a bump playing in that offense. But with Mahomes, his numbers are getting bloated because of the offense, but his performances, independent of the offense, have been phenomenal too. He threw one interceptable pass this season so far on about 130 attempts, which is a crazy number. His first one, it was this week. It was a deep shot on an extended play where he's trying to force the ball into a window downfield. But outside of that, he hasn't really done that. He's made consistently good decisions, hit windows with timing, and just simply been everything that Andy Reid has ever wanted him to be.
Yeah. How the hell does this happen? How does he fall to the middle of the draft? How did he sit on the bench for the vast majority of last year? Like, how does somebody get this good in the NFL with it almost being a little bit of a secret?
Well, he needed to sit on the bench for a year. In college, he wasn't this good. He had major, major, major footwork issues. So his feet would be all over the place. He'd be imbalanced throwing the ball. And it threw off the whole timing of what he was doing, and it also threw off all of his accuracy. So the idea that he should have started in week one last year, it's off. He needed the time to sit. You could see that even when he played in week 17 last year. Or the idea that you could take him and put him in any other offense in the league and he'd be just as good, I don't think that either. I think he's one of the rare situations, in my opinion, rare at least, where the player needed to sit and stay on the sideline for a while. When you have footwork issues, you can benefit from staying on the sideline. Generally, outside of that, when you've got processing issues or accuracy issues, it's generally better to play. But it's when specifically your feet that need to be fixed, it's better to have time on the sideline with a coach telling you what to do over and over and over and over again and kind of changing that muscle memory a little bit.
So how many other situations could you have gone into and been successful? Like, I suspect that Bill Belichick would have been able to fix him and he could have arrived at some point in the next couple of years whenever Brady's ready to go. But are there any other coaches and coaching situations and scenarios where it was so perfect a situation that Patrick Mahomes could have thrived?
Well, it's still only been a month. He is going to struggle more than he has to this point. I think Andy Reid is generally the best at this. So he gets guys like Nick Foles, he gets guys like Kevin Cobb, who didn't turn out eventually but was good with Reid, and he develops them. He knows what to look for in a quarterback, he knows how to set them up. I think I think this is more of a general point than a specific to Mahomes. I think the coaches who spread the field out, who get more receivers on the field, who put more options into their play, rather than having the specific plays with 6 and 7 and 8 blockers and guys who run vertical routes all the time, I think those coaches do better. So you're looking at guys from the Andy Reid coaching tree, Doug Peterson, Matt Nagy. You're looking at guys from Kyle Shanahan and Matt LaFleur and Sean McVay. Basically, the good coaches in the league right now, rather than just picking specific ones for specific quarterbacks. It's the guys who are building expansive offense, the guys who embrace diversity, and the guys who are actually thinking about changing their offense each week, rather than coaches like Jason Garrett in Dallas, who runs the same thing every week and it struggles every week.
Denver was supposed to be the first opportunity for us to see Patrick Mahomes nationally televised, but also up against a proper defense. And Von Miller was off the field for the end of the game, so I don't know if he's not fit enough or whatever it was, but it seemed a little bit weird. Are Denver not as good as advertised, first off, and so is this the week when they're up against the Jags that finally we get to go, oh, now we've seen you up against a proper defense? Or is he just so good that it doesn't really matter?
Well, it's not like he tore them apart. It's not like he did to the Steelers what he did to the Broncos. I think that defense did pretty well against them. They neutralized Travis Kelce for the most part. Sammy Watkins going out obviously hurt, and Tyreek Hill didn't have that big game. I noticed as well with Von Miller throughout the game, normally he's like an every down linebacker. But you notice in some of the first downs and some of the longer second downs where you were expecting a run play, he wasn't on the field, which was intriguing to me. So that is something to watch. I think the interesting part of it was you had a secondary there with Chris Harris and Bradley Roby who could actually cover these receivers in single coverage a little bit, which no one else has been able to do. The Jaguars, I think the Jaguars will be able to, but there's a style issue here. Jalen Ramsey is a long, tall cornerback. He's a better version of Xavier Rhodes. And if you watched the Rams and Vikings game last week, you saw Brandon Cooks get away from Xavier Rhodes over and over and over again. And a big part of that is Brandon Cooks is 5'10", 5'11", whatever he is. Xavier Rhodes is 6'2", 6'3". And it's very hard to use your body against a smaller receiver like that. So when Andy Reid goes into this matchup, he's got Tyreek Hill, Chris Conley, DeMarcus Robinson, Sammy Watkins to a lesser extent, because Sammy Watkins is a little bit taller, but he's got these guys who are small, who are going to make these lateral cuts that I don't think Jalen Ramsey's going to be able to keep up with. AJ Bouye might be better than him at that, but I think where this game will kind of be won and lost is on the defensive line, because Calais Campbell and Malik Jackson and the rest of that defensive line will be able to stop the run while getting pressure with only four, and that will ease the stress on the coverage outside, and it'll make it easier to stop those option plays that Mahomes and Andy Reid run.
So the Jags should win, even in Arrowhead.
I don't know about that. I think this is one of the toughest tests they'll get. I got some abuse this week on the podcast that we do, on the Interceptable podcast, because I said unless they actually lose to one of these teams, they're going to go 16-0. And it's just hard to imagine them going 16-0, which is a very Trent Dilfer thing to say, because unless they win, they lose kind of a thing. I don't know. But my point there is someone is going to have to beat them at some point.
Someone good. Good. Yeah. I get you. I'm with you.
It feels like these matchups we're going to have to pick out, because there are going to be games where they're just blowing teams out and it's not even a contest. This is one of the games where it'll be tight and where it'll be close, I think.
Is their defense improved? I mean, it was interesting that they were putting together a package for Earl Thomas before he broke his leg. That's understandable. Adding Earl Thomas to that defense is obviously going to improve them. Is their defense as bad as everybody thinks it is?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I think they got bailed out by the Broncos quite a bit because Trevor Siemian's arm is so limited that he missed a couple of throws. The interception you saw, the ball was behind Cortland Sutton and it went straight to the defender. But there was another play early in that game where Sutton caught a deep comeback and it turned into a fourth down rather than a first down because the ball was so slow to get to him. But also, they went away from the run too quickly. Royce Freeman and Patrick Lindsay, I think is his name, is the undrafted rookie. They were both running through, cutting that defense apart, and then the play calling on the Broncos side went to too many passes on early downs, and it kind of got the defense off the hook a little bit. Look, you still have D Ford, you still have Justin Houston, Eric Berry's coming back. I think Kendall Fuller will be better the more he plays in the system. I think they'll get a little bit better as the season goes along, but that could be, they'll be the 25th defense in the league rather than the 32nd. I don't think it's going to be average, above average, or even good.
Good enough, though, to reach a championship game and potentially a Super Bowl?
If that offense keeps going the way it is, they'll be the favourites in the AFC.
Yeah, okay. It was never my intention to talk about the Tennessee Titans, but I'm just interested in how they've managed to squeak through games through what looks like brilliant coaching in the face of significant troubles at quarterback up to this point. And, you know, it happens once, you're like, okay, fair enough, that was a bit gimmicky. But then it happens week after week after week, and you're like, hang on a second. You start looking at the talent they have and the intention that they have to try and be creative. And they start winning games in difficult fashion against good teams. Like, this is a real team now.
Yeah, we do this little, like, the way we pick coach of the year every year is we have these expectations on every team, and if one team wins more than we expect them to win, we assume it's coaching. And that's kind of what we're doing with the Titans right now, because Mike Vrabel has mismanaged his quarterback situation completely. He was starting Blaine Gabbert, and when Marcus Mariota was clearly healthy enough to play, because he was Mariota was the only backup quarterback who was active. So he's kind of got lucky a little bit in that Gabbert got hurt and Mariota was forced back onto the field. From a play-calling point of view, Matt LaFleur is there. He's a Sean McVay disciple. He was with the Rams last year. He's diversified that offense. They look so much better. I'm actually writing about their comeback right now because the comeback was phenomenal. They had 3 fourth downs in that game in overtime. Mariota didn't miss a throw after the second quarter. Well, in the second half, after throwing an ugly interception at the end of the second quarter. A big key for the Eagles' point of view was that Rodney McLeod is on IR. He went out last week. He's out for the season. And Corey Graham has been pushed into his starting spot. And Graham was someone they went after a couple of times on key plays. They had a big throw in overtime that was actually dropped by Darius Jennings. It would have been a game winner. And then they had a big throw to Taywan Taylor to convert to 4th and 15 at the expense of Graham. I think this Titans team is a lot better than people realize, but it's also one of those teams that I feel like is probably a year away from being truly very, very good, because the defensive back seven needs to get better, and they need one more weapon at wide receiver or tight end.
Mariota was unable to feel the nerves in his throwing hand, and like, you take that into consideration, and maybe his performances aren't going to be lights out this year, but they're going to be fairly gutsy, and he's got a little bit of a running ability, and he's pretty good. He's not brilliant.
I generally think he's brilliant when he's healthy. I think he's one of the best quarterbacks in the league when he's healthy. He's just not been in a situation to thrive. I'm not that concerned about his hand anymore, because like they said, this was a nerve issue. They said there was nothing really to do about it. It was just a wait and see and wait till it comes back. But he made two 50-plus-yard throws in this game straight down the middle of the field. The ball traveled about 60 yards in the air. It was perfectly fine. They were both accurate. So the big question was, could he throw a corner out or a deep out route where he's got to put the ball over a cornerback and fit it in below a safety? You definitely need to be able to grip the ball to do that, obviously. He made that 4th and 15 throw, one of the more difficult throws you're going to have to make as a quarterback. So I don't have any issue with him right now. I think he's probably healthy again, and this isn't something that's going to linger and impact his play much longer, because if you can play like that for 3 quarters, I know it was an overtime and isn't really a quarter, but they went so long, it was one long drive, it was a 16-play drive. I think you can do that over weeks. It's not going to be something that's going to be an issue again next week or a week after.
Okay. You were on the Dolphins train before the season started. I don't know, maybe we shouldn't overreact to them completely shitting the bed last week, and actually they're still 3-1, and I don't know. Sometimes these things happen when you're up against an old rival. You get spooked a little bit. It was so important for the Patriots to win. A few things go against you, the game gets away from you. It's a complete blowout, but really, if you lose a close game, you know, this is American football, this happens all the time. So are you off that train as a matter of that one result, or do you still think they've got a good shot at winning that division?
I've facetiously been calling this the Patriots Super Bowl this week because it did feel like that game was something they desperately needed to win. And for the first quarter, it really looked like what you expected it to be. It was really close. They got to a third down early in the second quarter. Cordarrelle Patterson caught a 55-yard touchdown. And it was on a play where the Patriots ran a pick play on the left. And it was either Minka Fitzpatrick or Xavier Howard. It's one of them is 25, one is 29, and the Dolphins' numbers are impossible to tell one from the other. So it was one of their cornerbacks who completely blew his assignment and let Patterson go wide open down the sideline. And that miscommunication led to the long touchdown, and then it kind of felt like everything just snowballed from there and the Dolphins' game got out of hand. If that had happened at home, I'd be saying, yeah, the Dolphins are in trouble. But going on the road against a team that's desperate, a team with Belichick who knows them inside out and who knows how to set everything up and attack their weaknesses, I'm not too concerned about it. I think they'll win the home game. They'll win the return leg of it. I still feel like they'll be competing for the division. And I think overall, the talent there is generally better than what the Patriots have. I know the Patriots won the game convincingly and they blew them out, but that happens in the NFL sometimes. This Patriots team, I still think, has a lot of problems.
Yeah. Problems that they're fixing slowly. Yeah. Edelman comes back. We were talking a little bit earlier on about it with Sam, and just suddenly Josh Gordon means that you're not really double teaming Gronkowski as often, and you can keep possession if they're all being properly marked.
The difference is going to be that they're going to be able to attack every level of the defense at the same time. You're going to have Edelman working underneath, you're going to have Gronkowski working the seams and working intermediate, and you're going to have Gordon working intermediate and working deep. So suddenly Brady has someone to hit at every level, and you've got James White coming out of the backfield. Compare that to working on Philip Dorsett and Cordarrelle Patterson, and it's a completely different offense. It's basically getting two new guys coming out of training camp because this is such a different look. It's going to have a different identity next week.
Who are also brilliant. It's not like they're kind of waiver wire pickups who are no good. It's like top of the range, proper material.
It might be a little bit of a struggle for Edelman now, because I believe he's back this week, and yeah. They're playing Thursday night. They're playing the early game this week after a short week. It's against the Colts, so they'll probably feel like they can win that game regardless. So I'm not sure how much they'll ask Edelman to do.
Okay, the Dolphins are at the Bengals, who have been surprisingly good, even though Tyler Eifert goes off with a horrific ankle break, which is in the long run a really kind of serious thing for them, because this was an offense that was completely vanilla last season and still almost made it to the playoffs. This year it looked like they had a little bit, like we've just been talking about, you can attack it at different levels with the quality that they have. Taking Tyler Eifert out suddenly means that there's a lot more attention for AJ Green and a lot more asked of Tyler Boyd, and maybe John Ross is not the complete bust that everybody has been assuming he was, but still, he's definitely on the waiver wire in almost everybody's fantasy league. Do the Bengals need everything to go right for them to be good enough to compete, or can Andy Dalton actually take that step forward and carry this offense?
So I think Tyler Eifert is a really, really good tight end. I think he's a phenomenal football player when he's fully healthy. I think he's been a little bit sapped over the years because of all these injuries that he's had. But I don't think they're going to miss him that much because they have good backups there. I think Tyler Kroft is the main backup. You have CJ Uzoma, who I assume is still there. I haven't actually checked that today yet, so I could be wrong on that. But they have backup tight ends who are good enough to be effective and good enough to stretch the field down the seams. John Ross had a long touchdown against the Falcons, pulled up a little gimpy at the end of it, but it was a phenomenal play for him because it was him stretching the defense away from AJ Green, putting a safety in a position where he had to choose between double-teaming AJ Green or giving the deep ball up to John Ross. And when you do that, John Ross is going to be wide open. I think that offense has enough talent to be good or to be sustainable, to sustain production. I think the defense is where they're going to really win games, because I think that unit's going to get better as the year goes along as well, as they get their linebackers back healthy. They have a lot of talent in the secondary. They have a lot of talent on the defensive line. That's generally how you want to build a defense in today's NFL, because you're trying to stop the pass, to stop the run. The guy who I think they really need to keep healthy is Cordy Glenn at left tackle. That, and they were missing their rookie starter, Billy Price, at center last week. That's another big piece for them. That offensive line can be one of the better units in the league if those guys are healthy. The problem with Glenn is he's not been healthy over the years. He's had some major surgeries, so you're kind of watching that concern that he might go out at some point.
I want to talk about the Falcons at the Steelers. Atlanta are 1-3 and the Steelers are 1-2-1. So two victories between them so far into the season with eight games played between them is not what you would have expected preseason for this fixture. And yet, if I'm a supporter of either of these two teams, I'm much happier being an Atlanta fan given the injuries that they've suffered and how brilliant they have been in racking up points. You kind of feel like at least we're doing something very well, and if we could just get this other thing right, then maybe we're going to be okay here.
Yeah, but even further than that, you look at who the Falcons have played. They lost to the Eagles in week one. They beat the Panthers. They lost to the Saints. And they lost to the Bengals. That's four playoff teams. That's not like that's not going and tying with the Browns. Like, the Browns might make the playoffs, but the Browns still aren't a team you expect to be that good over the course of the season. So I don't really feel bad about... This is kind of a difficult one for two teams to put together, because I think the Steelers have a quarterback problem, and I think their defense is awful, one of the worst in the league. But I think the Falcons have played good teams, and they've played them well. I think Matt Ryan's been playing pretty well. I think the offense works. But how does the defense actually get better from here? You've lost your starting inside linebacker, you've lost your starting strong safety, and you've lost your starting free safety in a defense that heavily relies on those three positions. I don't see how that can get better. So the Falcons are going to have to win shootouts, and I'm not sure Matt Ryan and that offense is that good. It's good enough to put up 25 points a game. It's good enough to blow out some teams, but I don't think it's going to be able to win shootouts often enough for them to make a playoffs from a 1-3 start.
Do you make a trade at this point? Like, do you go all in? Like, we've seen we've seen teams who believe their quarterback or their Super Bowl window's open, they lose their quarterback and they trade for him. You think of the Vikings a couple of years back when Teddy Bridgewater goes out. Like, why not trade for like some good defensive players when it looks like you have a Super Bowl window open?
Well, from one point, trading for a quarterback is more expensive than trading for any other position, but it's also trading for one player. So if to fix this Falcons defense, you need to add a linebacker, you need to add two safeties, at least one safety. So first off, you're going to have to give up pieces for them. Second off, you're going to have to think that those defenses are going to fit in what you do and how long it's going to take them to learn the defense and figure everything out. By that time, you could be 1-5 and 1-6. And then suddenly you've given up high draft picks for players who aren't going to help you because your season's already over. From the Falcons' point of view, they can't really tank. They have too much on offense. Their coach is... He's probably safe regardless of what happens this year, but he's not a coach who's going to go and tank and try and rebuild the team or whatever. They're just not at that stage of their development curve. So I can see them just playing this season out, being a really tough team for everyone they face, probably finishing 6-10, 7-9, 5-11 maybe even, and it's just going to be one of those seasons. It happens. You lose your players to injury. The 49ers are in that situation as well for a different reason, because they've lost their starting quarterback. But this is kind of one of the things Aaron Schatz used to say to me at Football Outsiders was, predicting football isn't hard, predicting who's going to get hurt is. So that's kind of one of these situations where the Falcons just have too many injuries and they're just unlucky.
The Rams have started to get some injuries as well, and even notwithstanding that, they still look absolutely fantastic. At some point, the injuries will bite with the Rams. In the meantime, what their coach appears to be able to do in transforming somebody who everybody thought was a mediocre quarterback to now a potential MVP candidate, even just utilising Todd Gurley properly over the last 18 months, like, we are witnessing a young coaching genius almost at the peak of his powers, as if he was born a genius.
Yeah, and I will touch on the injuries just before I talk about Sean McVay and the offense. Marcus Peters was expected to miss that game, and he played. And once I saw that he was playing, I kind of thought, oh yeah, the Vikings are going to go after him and exploit him a little bit. But they couldn't. He looked 100%. He didn't look like he was struggling at all. So maybe they've only lost to leave, and maybe the defense will be all right in the long term. Yeah, offensively, Jared Goff gets all the praise because he gets all the numbers. He had all the big scores. And he had probably three plays in that game that I thought were plays I didn't think Jared Goff could make and didn't think Jared Goff will ever make consistently. One was the corner touchdown to Cooper Kupp in between two defenders, threw it over the underneath coverage in front of Mike Hughes, who was covering on the back of Kupp, which is a phenomenal throw. One was the deep throw to Brandon Cooks, a long touchdown, traveled 53 yards past the line of scrimmage, hit him in stride, perfect throw. And one was a play in the fourth quarter when he bootlegged out of the pocket, moved to his left and threw the ball across his body to Cooks again just before he hit the sideline. So those are three throws I didn't think Goff could ever make. Outside of that, I didn't really see much from Goff that told me, hey, he's playing phenomenally well, or he's transcending his situation, have got much better. What was happening there, McVay had this perfect play calling to attack the Vikings defense. The Vikings defense is full of downhill players, aggressive players, and they suffocate you if you're just going to try and line up and run the ball or line up and drop back and pass, and they will just overwhelm you with their talent. But when you get them moving laterally, moving side to side, it's the same thing that the Bills did to them. When you use a lot of play action, use a lot of option routes or option looks from the backfield, it's really difficult for them to control their momentum and match what you're doing. So McVay used play action, I think, on 54% of his snaps in that game. The league average, or the highest in the league last year, was 32%. So he had a very specific game plan to move the defensive line laterally, pull the coverage apart, and create wide open throws for Goff from clean pockets. And that happens because you've got Andrew Whitworth there, who's a phenomenal left tackle, who I think he's someone we need to start talking about a little bit more because he was in Joe Thomas's shadow for all those years. Joe Thomas, obvious Hall of Famer. I think at this point, Andrew Whitworth is an obvious Hall of Famer too. So I think the whole offense there works brilliantly. It's all based off of what McVay does. The offensive line and Gurley are the main components of their success. Goff comes after that, and then the wide receivers are at the end.
Yeah, it's not a bad combination, and certainly it's pretty sweet to watch. Final quick question for you about the stuff that happened last week, and maybe it didn't get as much play as it would have done if a lot of other stuff hadn't been happening, but did Mitchell Trubisky become a man last week?
Wait, what did he do? That's a weird question. Mitchell Trubisky made the play a little. Actually, this is kind of the timing of these two questions together is a bit odd, but he kind of did what Jared Goff did, where he made a couple of outstanding plays. One was a throw down the left side to Taylor Gabriel. One was to Allen Robinson for a touchdown. Outside of that, it was kind of plays you expect your quarterback to make because the Buccaneers couldn't react to Matt Nagy's play designs. And so he had, again, wide open receivers, wide open tight ends, and Terry Cohen was phenomenal, and he was throwing from clean pockets over and over again. He did what you expected him to do throughout the first month of the season, throughout the whole season. The only reason this game was notable, outside of the six touchdowns, the only reason it was notable to me was he had been so bad the previous 3 weeks that this game was something he really needed. And I think it will be huge for his confidence just because it looked like for the first three weeks he was just thinking about everything too much. Like his confidence was completely shot and he was just doing things that he had done with ease during his rookie season. This game, he had a couple of struggles at the very start, but he had an early big plays as well, and he completely settled down. His accuracy was there, his decision-making was there, his awareness was there. He had a couple of big runs in this game. One was an option keeper, one was a long scramble. I think he's a really good quarterback. I think the offense is really good as a design when it's called properly. The play calling has been inconsistent to this point, but when it's called well, it's really hard to stop. I just feel like we're going to go to this thing, what we always do with, hey, he got six touchdowns, he must have been phenomenal. And we forget that there was a point in not so long ago that Ryan Fitzpatrick threw six touchdowns for the Texans and then got benched about 3 weeks later.
Yeah, Nick Foles obviously, was it seven, whatever his record was. But I guess the point about Trubisky is that he was such a high pick, there was so much pressure on him, there wasn't very much around him last season. They've completely changed. They've got someone who is part of that genius coaching tree. They've got an amazing defense. Like, it's possible that Trubisky and this Bears team are a playoff team.
Oh yeah, I was focusing on the micro there of that game. I think this is one of the better teams in the league, and I really, really like Mitch Trubisky as a quarterback. I think he has the potential to be one of the best in the league. I just don't think this week's game was an indicator of him turning the corner into being that great guy. It's him turning the corner away from being awful.
Yeah, it felt, when you're talking about 1 week, things seem to be very fast for him, and the second week it slows down. It's almost as if a penny drops in some ways. All careers need a little bit of a boost along the way where you go, okay, I get this, I understand what I'm supposed to be doing. And it appears a little bit like that happened last week.
Well, my focal point is always on the majority of what a player has done. So at this point, Mitch Trubisky, 90% of his career has been really impressive play. The 10% has come the first 3 weeks of the season. Whereas if you're talking about, I know it's probably not a fair comparison because Josh Allen has only been playing for a month, but if you go back to last week and look what Josh Allen did against the Vikings, it was all very simple. It was all very easy. It wasn't anything to do outside of his skill set. Yeah. And he regressed this week against the Packers and had an awful game. Whereas, so when I take those two individual performances, you look at Josh Allen's and you see the good is the aberration. And I look at Mitch Trubisky's and I think the bad is the aberration. So for the over the long term, you feel like the majority of what he's done is going to win out. So I think Trubisky is going to be very good over the long term. Whereas someone like Josh Allen, who has blips of high production, blips of good performances, I think he's going to struggle more because of his majority of the sample.
Okay, that's a fair point. Keen, you're writing about the Titans' comeback. Anything else you're writing about this week?
No, I'm travelling this week, unfortunately, after today. Well, I say unfortunately, I don't mean that. I'm travelling happily, but I won't be doing too much this week. Next week, I'll be back again, writing an article every day on the Patreon and on my Twitter. So,
okay, if anybody wants to sign up for your Patreon, where do they go?
It's patreon.com at KeanAF, C-I-A-N-A-F. Same
awesome.
As Twitter.
Keen, good stuff. Thanks very much. Enjoy your travels and we'll talk to you real soon. Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
It's Keen Fahey with us there. Every week here on the OTB NFL pod. Apologies, as I said a little bit earlier on, for missing last week's show. It won't happen again between now and the Super Bowl. We might take the week off between the Super Bowl and the divisional rounds. I haven't decided that yet, but who cares? It's too far away. Thanks very much for being with us. Tell all your buddies. Give us 5 stars out of 5, even if you think the content is shit. And we'll see you next week. Thanks a million.